Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest joining us from the UK is James Williamson. He is author of They Can't Touch Him Now. Honest and Unflinching, They Can't Touch Him Now is a harrowing portrait of the lifelong psychological impact of childhood neglect and abuse. James Williamson's detailed account of the disturbingly common events which led to his own abuse reminds us that children are easily target for sexual predators and that parents and educators must pay close attention to changes in children's behavior, highlighting the importance of trust and communication at home and at school. You can find out more about James's book by visiting his website, which is jameswilliamson-taylor.com, and I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome James to the show. Good day, James.
Hello, Robert. Good afternoon.
I'm so happy to have you here. Even though the topic you wrote about is one of those that is sometimes difficult to discuss, it's just so very important to have an open discussion about it.
Well, yes, and I mean, that's really why I wrote the book, to give people the opportunity to see how things happen. And, yeah, perhaps, as you said, trust is something that's terribly important and I think probably too freely given today. By some people, they don't really think about it. And I think you've got to be a bit more aware of what's going on as a parent, especially with regard to who you trust.
Yeah, I agree. And now let's start with, to me, when you told your story, I mean, and you have got a lot of details on a lot of different topics that I'd like to talk about, but this is such a personal story. I mean, this is, you're kind of putting out there for the world to see all of the challenging circumstances that you went through. When anyone does that, that's very courageous. Tell me about when you got to that point that you realized you were going to take this story and write about it and make it public. Because up till then, I'm sure it wasn't maybe discussed very often.
It was never discussed. I never told a soul about any of this, including my partner. Nobody knew. And then I'd always wanted to write. And the time was right. For me to sit down and think, okay, let's write a book or a story or whatever. And I just couldn't come up with anything. The ideas weren't flowing. And I thought, well, hang on a moment, look at my own past. If there's ever an interesting story to write about, it's got to be that. And I had to give some thought to people that it might affect if I put these words down for people to read. And so some of it I waited until I felt confident that I could put things in writing without hurting anybody.
That's a very important thing. I mean, to especially when you're dealing with and people who know you who are going to make associations to really identify who the individuals are.
Yeah. And, obviously I was, as one of the things that sort of happened to me in the early days was I was adopted under somewhat unusual circumstances. And my adopted parents had no idea of what was going on. So I didn't want them involved or hurting any way, maybe feeling that they hadn't quite got it right. They did the best they could. So that's why and of course the main perpetrator also is dead. hence the title, They Can't Touch Him Now.
I can see now that, you know, those circumstances are gone. That they're gone, and, you know, that you can actually tell your story. I think it's just one of those things where, you know, it's very, it takes a lot of strength, you know, to kind of, you know, put down the words and then come on shows like mine, you know, and kind of go through it again. But communicating your experience and your feelings and all of the emotions that you went through, that, you know, being able to communicate, that's really kind of the key to helping others who may be going through that, correct?
Well, yes. And I sort of recollected what had happened, I've got a pretty good memory, and I can sort of remember pretty much how I felt at that time. So the book is sort of written that the reader grows up, or I grow up with the reader, if you like. It's not sort of childish, but it's boyish thoughts, boyish recollections of how I thought my circumstances were at the time. And, of course, like many children, the first sort of episode of abuse, of physical abuse that happened in my life, I thought I was to blame. I thought that was my fault. And I was only then about 9, and I thought, well, okay, I can't go home and say anything for fear of my parents maybe thinking that I was, you know, I'm adopted, I'm some kind of a reject, and maybe I could end up getting put into a children's home. So I thought, you know, no matter how bad things can be at home, and at times they were, that's got to be better than being in a children's home. So I was too scared to say anything, really, of what had happened. And that's what children do, you know. And that's what people that prey on children work on. You know, you cannot say anything because, and so on. So that's sort of how my life was, really, always keeping this secret. And that's what I did until that day I sat down and started to write the story.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've, you know, talked to other people who have sat down to try to write, and I kind of laugh because a lot of people have that, you know, what do I write about? And I say, well, you know, your story, your life experiences. Now, there was one woman I remember calling in when I told her that. She was like, oh, my God, I can't talk about me. You know, what would I, you know, and she just went into all kinds of, you know, reasons why she couldn't tell her life story. But, you know, it seems that, you know, really that's why we live this life, is for those experiences and to, you know, to learn from and to help others kind of make their life an easier experience.
Well, people have the wrong interpretation of someone that writes a story or writes a book. And, you know, when I first started to write, and I was talking about it one day, and someone said, well, are you famous? And I said, well, no, I'm not. But there are loads of people that write books that are not famous. They may end up that way, some of them. They don't start out that way. And all too often, which I, a thing about writing that I'm not keen on is that you're forever reading autobiographies about 22-year-old footballers and things like this, so-called famous people that had no life really to share with a reader, and yet they're suddenly instant bestsellers. And it's the weird thing about books, I guess, or that's one aspect of it anyway. I feel it's a bit weird, and I'm sure that there are a myriad of people out there that have got great stories, life stories to tell, and they never get told or read. So, as I said, if anybody says, you know, why, I said, well, initially, write it for yourself. Write it for your family. So just, if nothing else, your family get to know what your life was like when you were young.
Yeah, because, you know, telling your story has to, I mean, because all of those experiences that you had obviously combine, you know, to make the person you are and explains your perception of life, also, you know, many things with children and cinemas and scouts. And I mean, there's a lot of things that we'll talk about shortly, but I mean, there's just so much experience there that, you know, if they understood your life, then it would make it, I would think it would make it easier to be able to understand you, to communicate, you know, and basically build a trust.
Sorry, I didn't quite get the end of that.
Yeah.
Basically,
I would say build a trust, you know, like build it in relationships,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. So,
it's a difficult.
Go ahead.
It is a very difficult subject, that's for sure, and it's difficult to write. It wasn't easy. It's easy to recall it, but when you've got to write something like that, firstly, it has to be written in a way that it's not titillating or salacious to the wrong people. So you've got to be very cautious about how you put down in words what's happened to you. You don't want to sort of excite the wrong people, but you want to get your story across. So I had to give a lot of thought to that. And I hope, according to those that have so far commented on it, they feel it achieved that, which is great, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you know, honestly, I would never have thought about that. You know, that is such, but it's so important. I mean, you know, it's just keeping that in mind. You know, that delicate balance. You know, I could see where that would have been a challenge. But again, that was something I would never have thought about. You know, let's start with kind of going through some of the experiences and kind of maybe how they all kind of contributed or added to. I mean, basically, you indicated that, you know, you were adopted and that, you know, you had this, there was some feelings of, like, with all people who are adopted, not with all, but with many who are adopted, there's a sense of abandonment, you know, that kind of goes along with that. So would you mind sharing with the listeners just a little bit about, you know, I think you said that there was an unusual circumstance that led to that. Would you mind kind of sharing with the audience a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, certainly. I was my mother's fifth child, and she gave birth to me in a hospital on south of the River Thames, South London. And somehow she got to meet this man, and I was ill, actually. I was ill. I was in hospital with gastroenteritis, which in those days, 1948, was a killer for children. So I was in hospital. She moved from one side of the river to the other, and she met this man called Tommy, and he introduced her to his brother and his brother's wife. I recovered and came out of hospital, and my mother hadn't told anybody about me, so she said that I was her sister's baby, and her sister had cancer. So my adopted or about-to-be adopted parents said, well, would it help if we looked after Michael? That was my name then, Michael John. Would it help if we looked after him for a week or two, which they did? And that led to them asking if they could adopt me. And when it went to court, because there was no adoption society, I was just signed over, the sort of truth came out about who I belonged to, not her sister, but actually her. And shortly after then, she disappeared. I have to say that it took me about 45 years because of very difficult complications with names, etc. I've actually found my real family. So that's another bit of story of my life that may sort of come to light one day. But I found that my mother actually went on to have six more children after me, which made me really wonder why I was adopted. You know, why would you have six more? So I turned out to be one of 11 as opposed to the fifth. So, adopted under slightly unusual circumstances, my father was an illiterate scaffolder and with an unpredictable and sometimes violent temper. So when you mention abandonment, at those bad times in your life as a child, you can't do anything. You just have to put up with things. You can't run away, can't walk away, you're too young. And I used to wonder, you know, why my mother had sort of left me in this situation. But you just get on with it. You know, there's nothing you can do but get on with it, which is what I did.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a bunch of unusual circumstances, and to go on to have 6 more children afterwards, that's just confusing.
That confusion came about when I was an adult, because it was only about 2 years, just over 2 years ago, I found them. But prior to then, of course, then, you know, you do wonder why you've been abandoned. And then, of course, our life in those days, or life in those days in East London, was, I mean, incredibly different to today. We're sort of like, it's like light years away today, because we have so much in life, so material things in life now, that we didn't have any of that then. Food was still on ration after the Second World War, so there was many things that couldn't be bought in a shop. In America, you get one of our TV programs called Call the Midwife. And I don't know if you've seen it, but maybe if you haven't, perhaps some of your listeners have. And that is actually set in my era and where I was brought up. So anybody sees that, they can see on a screen how my life was like, because that's how it was. We lived in a shared house because housing was short after the Second World War, because there was so much bomb damage done in East London. So we lived in a shared house, a family upstairs. We lived downstairs, and we had no running hot water, and we had an outside toilet. So it was a very, very basic life. And a bath was, well, when I was a kid, I used to sit on the draining board of the sink. My mum used to wash me down. Or once a week, there was the tin bath in front of the fire. And that's as life was in those days for me growing up.
Wow. That is, you know, scarce. I mean, you know, when you think about it. Now, this was with your adopted family? Those were the conditions?
Yes.
Yes. Boy. And now, one of the things that you mentioned on your webpage, and you talk about in your book, is that, you know, the first instance of sexual abuse occurred when you were when you went to a cinema. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, I was 9, and I liked that we didn't have a television then. So the only time we ever went out to see something on a screen was to the cinema. And I liked war films, and there was plenty of them after the Second World War. They were being churned out left, right, and center. And there was one that was on, I wanted to go and see, and I was allowed to go off on my own in the evening. I was 9 years old. There was no real, seemingly real dangers in those days for children, so I sort of went off to this cinema. And that was the days of what we call rolling movies, when you went in and you probably go in the middle of a film, you watch the end of it, you watch the B movie, and then you watch the beginning of the film. It's all out of sequence, but that's, you know, if you didn't get the timing right. So I walked into the cinema with guns blazing on a battleship, couldn't see anybody, just sat down, and then shortly afterwards this man come and sat next to me, and that's what was led on to my first experience, which I've covered quite in detail, but careful detail in the book. But that man actually, after sort of touching me, followed me out, and then it sort of happened again. But like to think that book. Well, I don't have a problem talking about it, but I feel that it's probably better expressed.
Better in the book. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I just
so
want to.
After that,
I'm sorry. I was just going to say kind of wanted to set the stage for the time, you know, your age, you know, when it happened, and you know, and then this was, you know, a public area, even though it was dark. But it was a public area, and those are still some things that parents and guardians have to be very aware of, you know, when it comes to protecting their children.
Well, absolutely. Of course, today we live in a different world today because children now, I mean, most people have houses, they've got two cars, they take the kids everywhere by car, whereas I walked to school, I walked to the cinema, I was allowed to go out during the day to a park or whatever. That wouldn't happen so much today. But still these things happen, and invariably it's because people get too trusting. Parents just get too trusting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that you also talk about, and speaking of trust, is that, you know, when you, like you mentioned earlier in the show, when that occurred and then you went home, you were reluctant to say anything because you just were confused about, you know, like at fault, why, you know, that kind of thing. But also the importance of being, I mean, of course, you indicated that your stepfather had possibly, you know, times of violence, you know, so that, you know, and as an adoptee, you know, I mean, there had to have been a flood of emotions that were kind of going through you at the time, and didn't know where to turn.
Yeah, absolutely. Didn't know where to turn, what to say, anything. So I just said nothing and just kept it to myself. And that's the way it remained. And I don't know who that man was, and my parents are now dead, and it seemed sort of, I could sort of tell this story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, now, you know, with the keeping with the idea of trust, you then also had an experience with a scoutmaster. Now, those are people who are, you know, quite often put in positions that parents would place a lot of trust, you know, in someone who is a scoutmaster. Again, and this kind of goes back to the importance of, like you mentioned, of being careful who you trust and how easily you put trust in. But that was then kind of where you went to next, as far as trying to get some sense of security or some kind of understanding.
Well, what happened there is because, as I said, we had very little, and I was an only child, I joined the Scouts because I'd heard about it, and it was a great opportunity to be with other boys and do the things that Scouts do, games and camping and all sorts of things. And you're right, Scoutmasters are in a position of trust, but I also like to say and make it very clear that I don't feel that all Scoutmasters are bad, and I think I'm certain that they have to sort of, they're more investigated before they're allowed to take up that position in this day and age. Whereas in those days, I'm sure anybody could have been a Scoutmaster. I so enjoy the Scouts. So I'd like to just make it clear that I really believe that Scouting Association is absolutely fantastic for boys. And I believe, and I don't believe for a minute that all Scoutmasters are bad. A very high percentage of them are excellent men that do an excellent, honest, trustworthy job. And so I wouldn't want a parent to think, oh, no, I wouldn't let my boy go to Scouts because they'd be thinking wrong if they did that. It just so happened that this was a different era. Like now, for example, even if you do voluntary work, you are investigated by the Criminal Records Office to make sure that you don't have that criminal record. In those days, none of that was done. So, you know, I joined the Scouts. I got a great deal out of it. And our Scoutmaster, who was fantastic, was offered another job in another part of the country and took that job because it meant his future was more secure. Because, I mean, obviously what he did as a scout wasn't his full-time job. That was an evening voluntary job, two nights a week or two evenings a week. So he moved off and we got a replacement Scoutmaster. And that's when the problem, if you like, began. He sort of perhaps noticed something in me and exploited that. And I said in the book, that Tom offered me conditional kindness. He threw me a barbed lifeline, which I needed. And when I grabbed hold of it, I was hooked. And he invited me to his flat, or his apartment, as you call it, and I was sort of asked if I would become part of a small committee involved in organizing the summer camp, which seemed a fine thing to be doing. And he was instigated through a lot of effort that we, as a troop, bought our own van that would take our kit to a campsite, which made life a lot easier for us. And he did a lot of work to raise that money. But we needed a driver. And my father was asked if he would drive. And that's when the family connection, the trust came in. Because my father became the occasional driver, because it was only weekend, the odd weekend camps here and there and so on, and the summer camp for 2 weeks. And, of course, Tom was known by them. They knew Tom. So, you know, why not trust him? He was trustworthy. And that's what was going on. So Tom provided me a place to go that was quiet, away from my father's volatile temper, a place that I felt secure and comfortable. And that's how that sort of evolved.
Okay. Well, yeah, you know, and see, that evolvement, or that how things unfolded, those are, I can see, even though, you know, that was back in that time, I can see the scenario still in today's environment happening. Maybe different events and different kinds, you know, different types of, you know, some things change. But generally speaking, that process of first association and then feeling trust, you know, trusting in the individuals, I mean, that kind of process, I'm sure, still goes on. So it's kind of, that was one of the things that I hope the listeners will garner from today's show, is just to be aware, just to have a little heightened sense of awareness when that occurs, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it will never stop. I mean, you know, my book will never become old-fashioned or outdated, because it's a subject matter that will never change. And we've got this massive investigation going on in the UK at the moment called Operation Yew Tree, where TV celebrities have been found to be guilty of these crimes. And we've had one or two that have been imprisoned. One of them was greatly involved with children, and used to compare a famous children's TV show, funny enough, called Jim Will Fix It. And kids would write in and say, oh, you know, I'd like it possible to do so and so, and Jim would fix it so that child could do that. And this man was an absolute blatant paedophile, but he's now dead. So there's nothing to do about it. But then there's one or two that have been found guilty now that are actually alive and now in prison. And one of those is an Australian guy that lived in the UK called Rolf Harris. And he used to have children in his audience, and he's a great artist and so on. It's amazing how these things happen. Quite amazing. Mm. But it's a topic that's never going to go away. It's never going to go away, this topic. It's always going to be going on. And hopefully, anyone out there that's listening to a program that's got a boy of 11 or a girl of 11 will think very carefully about letting that child walk about, come home on its own, or you know, check things out before giving that trust away so freely.
Yeah, and particularly, I guess, in today's environment with social media and the worldwide connection, it is really crazy. I mean, there's so many connections that are now possible that weren't back then, you know, that make it even, the need to be cautious even more heightened. So.
Oh, it's incredible. And there was a thing on TV here this morning about sexting. And sexting is young kids being asked by somebody to send a picture of themselves, probably with little or no clothes on. But they don't know, they're not 100% certain who's asking them to do this. So I think parents today have a nightmare job compared to what my parents had, because they've got computer, the internet, they've got Facebook and text and mobile phones and so on. All these things that can lead to problems, parents have got to be so aware of. And, of course, the kids want this stuff. You know, they feel, you know, must have. It's a must have society. And so parents have got such a difficult job, I think, at the moment. What I'm saying might sound a bit trite to turn around and say, you know, you need to be more aware, but you've got to be infinitely more aware now because of all these different avenues that children can wander down, electronic avenues. It's just so difficult, but, you know, be on your toes, be on your guard.
Exactly. Well, James, we're a little past halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break and invite anyone listening, if you'd like to call in and ask James any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. Or for those of you listening live in the chat room, if you have a question that you would like for me to pose to James, feel free to type it in there. So, James, we're going to take just a quick 90-second break. But when we come back, what I'd like to talk about, you know, in the introduction I indicated that it's, you know, important for parents and educators to pay attention to changes in children's behavior. So after the break, I'd like to talk a little bit about that, and maybe we can just talk about the different types of behaviors to look for, what was your experience, and that kind of thing, okay?
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after, again, this very brief break.
Attention international show listeners and followers in Canada, the UK, Australia, and around the world. I am very happy to let you know that our online wellness store is set up to allow you to place orders in the language and country of your choice. These special essential oils, blends, and spa and salon products will be shipped from a distribution site nearest you. Simply go to our website, www.biteradio.me, and click on the wellness link. Once you enter the store, you can select the language and country of your location, and then shop away. Also, since these products are available worldwide, there is also an opportunity for you to become a wellness advocate yourself, where you can receive wholesale discount pricing and have the option to create an income for yourself. For more information about that opportunity, simply contact me by email at biteradio@me.com. That's biteradio@me.com. Or send me a message via Skype at my username, Bite Radio. Make health and wellness your priority today.
Okay, everyone. Thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest joining us from the UK is James Williamson. He is author of They Can't Touch Him Now. Again, you can find out more about James, his book, interview, new projects, and all that kind of information by visiting his website, which is jameswilliamson-taylor.com. And again, I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. Okay, with that, we're back, James.
Hello.
Okay, great. Good. Okay, well, you know, let's talk about behaviors, you know, because these are, I think, you know, those are the things that parents and guardians and educators really need to be, you know, aware of. So would you mind maybe talking a little bit about, you know, your experience, you know, and the types of behavior shifts that you had, and just maybe in general, you know, what the guardians can kind of keep an eye open for?
Well, I think the biggest thing really is, you know, let's be honest and upfront here, that, you know, I am a gay man. And I'm not quite sure what age that those feelings actually start for boys, but quite young, early teens. And so you can grow up, you're growing up maybe with feelings that are not usual for you, difficult to deal with, perhaps difficult to think, in this day and age more so than when I was a boy. But, you know, parental acceptance and all this business. And those attributes, those feelings, are very often spotted by, or can be spotted by, the wrong people. And so I think it's very important, and I know some people agree, disagree, whatever, about homosexuality, but it is there, and it is, you know, has to be accepted if it's your child. You know, this is going on in your life. And what you don't want is, you know, I think you've got to have the sort of dialogue with your children that they feel that they can talk to you. And that's, you know, not being able to discuss that aspect of your life, there's one aspect anyway, is a very difficult thing. And if somebody comes along and is sympathetic, a complete stranger, that's the wrong person to be listening to you. Your parents need to be listening to you and understand and be able to ask questions, and you need to be able to talk to them as a child, a young teenager. And I think that's very important. And I think that when, this is not every case, obviously, but it certainly was in mine and many others, where the wrong people home in on something and take advantage of it. And sometimes these incidents can work out where a child can be murdered, and often is, often has happened in the past, and parents are left bereft because they didn't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely heartbreaking. And an example of this, Robert, where there was a boy about 13 or 14, a blonde boy, hadn't said anything to his parents and so on, and used to go in, lived in a village in east of England, and used to pop into a shop to pick up, you know, sweets or whatever, chocolate, on his way home. And this shopkeeper honed in on this, what was going on with this boy, and somehow befriended him, murdered him, and some of this boy's hair was found in the U-bend underneath this man's sink, and that's how they found him. I just sometimes wonder if maybe his parents would have been perhaps a bit more aware of him, what was going on with him, and have talked to him, perhaps that boy would be alive today. And I'm not saying it's the parents' fault, and I'm really not, but
right,
just we have to be so much more aware today, because we do know about these things. I mean, nobody knew about that going on in when I was a boy.
Right.
Not like you do today.
Or it wasn't known. Yeah, it just wasn't out in the open.
That's right. It wasn't even legal. It was illegal in the UK until 1967. So, you know, you could be put in prison. But, you know, it's just one aspect of having that sort of relationship with your children, I think. Understanding that they can talk to you about anything. I think it's really important, because some things happen to children, as did with me. You know, there's no way that I could have talked to my parents about that. No way.
Yeah. Now,
what it led into.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, what do you, I know you say that there was like no way that you could talk to your parents about it. And I think there are probably a lot of kids out there now that think the same way. There's no way I can talk to my parents about it. What was, for you, what were the reasons that you felt that it couldn't be brought up? I mean, you know what I mean? You know, for kids out there who are maybe listening, or parents, you know, to try to set the proper stage, you know, what was it that led you to feel that you couldn't?
Well, simply because I didn't know about it. All I knew is that I was in this kind of relationship with my Scoutmaster, which I believed was wrong, but I couldn't say anything about it. I couldn't tell my parents about that. But I didn't know about it. As the book states, it starts and ends on my wedding day. I got married. And I didn't know about those things. Children today know about it. It's on television. You know, Will and Grace and so on. It's there for children to see. Yeah. I didn't know that it existed. My Scoutmaster didn't tell me that there was a life out there that you could lead because it was illegal. It wasn't a life you could lead. It was illegal. So things are very different today. Parents are more aware and children are more aware. They just need to be aware together.
Yeah,
the child
yeah.
needs to know that the parents knows about this and understands it. And this is not just me blowing my trumpet about being gay or homosexual, however people want to view it. This is about children. It's not about a lifestyle. This is about children and what they're going through and how the mess that they can get into with the wrong people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when I've had people on before who have had similar types of experience, you know, from the child's perspective, there's, first of all, like you say, there's a lot that's just not known, you know, I mean, just they don't have the life experience. But then there's also that predisposition to trust and not being able to discern really the motives of some people's actions.
Mm. Well, I don't understand it. I mean, I can't understand how any
yeah.
adult could get a child, particularly a very young child, and just do what they do or get the buzz or whatever from what they're doing. I just don't understand it. I don't understand the mentality. But it does happen, and you just have to really be aware. You know, you just have to be on your toes as a parent. And it was a case last year. A little girl, she was called April. I think she was about 3 or 4 out in the street in a little village in Wales. And her poor parents, bless them. I mean, you know, this little kid is out there playing with her little friends 1 second and gone the next.
Yeah.
Gone the next. Somebody in the village, somebody on their doorstep did this. So you've got to be aware. They're your children. You've got to be aware. Kids, you know.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and that's the one thing. You know, by telling your story and the circumstances, you know, I think, you know, first of all, there are going to be parents out there who, or are some adults even, you know, just plain adults who may have gone through similar types of experiences and possibly feel empowered to be able to tell their stories as well, which I think is important. The more you talk about it, even though, you know, each story may have some common thread, each is different and may resonate, you know, with one or two or even a dozen people out there.
Well, it's true. I did have somebody mention to me that I was doing this to make money. And I said, you know, that's utter rubbish. Utter rubbish. I mean, I don't see how authors, and there are many, many authors out there, make a lot of money out of writing books. There are one or two that are massive bestsellers. Yeah, they'll make money. But there's an awful lot of authors out there that are even paying to have their works published and, you know, print on demand and so on, because they want their stories to be read, and some of them are really good stories. And, you know, there was an Irish guy, I can't remember his name, who wrote a book called Angela's Ashes that became a movie. Never heard of before, but he wrote this good story about his life as a child, which wasn't easy. There was no sexual abuse, but it wasn't easy. He became famous and a bestseller and so on. I'm sure that there must be some absolutely fantastic stories out there to be told, and other people like myself that have been through this. My advice would be, well, first of all, just write it down. because that's cathartic in itself, just actually writing it down. And then go from there. If you don't want it to go further, don't let it, but just get it on paper, sit down and write it out. Pour your heart out to your computer.
Yeah, that is real important. And you said that when you wrote yours, you did it from what you, like your actual age at the time, from like the boy's perspective. So with other people who want to kind of do that, would you suggest they do the same thing, like the little boy or the little girl in them that experienced it, to have that frame of thought while writing?
Well, I think, you know, the things that you remember, you'll recall them as you thought then. So it's inevitable,
okay. You
know, you're going to write how you thought about something happening in your life at that time. So there is going to be an element of that in an autobiography. And what I have is a good memory of exactly how I thought about certain things, our lifestyle, the way we lived, the things that happened to me, my father's temperament. At that time, and you know, my dad was a rough scaffolder, a rough guy from East London, swore like a trooper. My mother was disabled; she'd had infantile paralysis, and they both worked. And of course, another thing that I wanted to put in the book, which I've tried to portray, is that as bad as my father was at times, and he could be really, really bad, he also had good aspects of him. You know, I had new clothes, new shoes. Loads of kids in my street didn't have new shoes. You know, secondhand clothes. They provided for me well. But the emotional side was a bit lacking. But, you know, I had food on the table. I had clothes on my back.
Yeah.
Which was important.
Yeah, those are. Yeah, I mean, those physical needs, you know, are important.
Uh-huh.
And you just also want to make sure that you can provide as much as emotional support as you can. And you know, in today's environment, with many families with both parents working, it can be a real challenge to get that quality time. That's really what is necessary to build up that trust. You know, and just the ability to be able to communicate anything, you know, which is so vital.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy. Now, if we were going to, gosh, we're down to about 10 minutes here, so I kind of want to wrap up a little bit in the sense of what you hope, you know, that the reader is going to get, you know, from by reading your book. You know, what is it the hope that what's your hope that the reader will take away from the book? Excuse me.
Well, I think it's an era. It's a story that's based in a certain time period in England, and in particular, obviously, America did. Although whilst the Americans came into the war, I know. But they didn't go through what we did in England, and their understanding of that may not be quite as good as, you know, the book portrays. So it's an explanation of how life was in those days, and we have this wonderful relationship between our two countries, and I know people are interested in England. So I wanted to sort of try and explain, look, this is how life was. This is what it was really like. It was not easy. It was a bit on the tough side. So I wanted a portray of how life was like then. So that was one part of the book. The other part was what adoption could be like for kids and probably for parents. And also, of course, then the physical and sexual abuse aspect, which is, so there's sort of more than one aspect in the book. It's not all about child abuse. It's about a way life was, child abuse in that period, if you like. Which is very different today. So, but people like that sort of that period of time to read about. And I've been told I have explained it in great detail that it's easy to picture and understand what it was like.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I want people to enjoy.
Okay, great. Well, you know, I mean, it's always nice to get a peek into, you know, kind of what other people's lives were in different periods and different parts of the world. You know, and with your particular story in the adoption aspect, do you think that, you know, when you're talking about awareness, that in particular parents who have adopted children kind of need to be especially aware of the of making sure that the child feels secure, because you know, because it seems that, you know, the when you talked back about the, you know, not going to your parents with the experience, that, you know, you felt that maybe you would be put back into a home or into a home. So, you know, it seems like the children, adopted children, may be especially vulnerable, I guess, to the to predators, you know, because of their the need for security.
Well, firstly, not all adopted children grow up to know.
No,
adopted.
Not all. But,
So, and I did. So there was that aspect. At least I knew that. So hence I could evaluate that in my own little way and think there's a risk of here. Lots of kids are growing up thinking that their mum and dad really is their mum and dad. And I don't advocate, you know, it's up to an individual's, it's an individual's choice as to whether they tell their child that it's an adopted child or not. But as long as the children are brought up just the same as their own children, but I think there needs to be a sort of slight awareness that there is that there are certain genetic issues with children and things that children are going to become that are not necessarily because of the way that they're brought up. It's the way that you are born, it's what you're born with. And so this is a bit of a surprise. It's like if I go to the doctor, Robert, and the doctor immediately says to me, okay, family history. I don't have any. I don't know it. Well, family history is important to the doctor because there's certain things that can happen to you that are relative to what happens to your family. And you don't know what they are, and nor does the adopted parent either. So there's going to be things that are going to crop up in life that, as an adopted parent, you're going to have to deal with.
Right.
So not necessarily just because you didn't feed them on the right bran flakes. You know, it's stuff that's just going to happen.
Yeah. You know, and I agree. You know, and those, I mean, those are things that, you know, unless you're in the situation of being adopted or adopting, that, you know, quite often you don't, really don't think about. But, you know, in your particular case, you know, the feelings that you experienced as an adopted child, even though the, you know, it was the circumstances were, you know, in England and poor, you know, back a little ways back, even in, you know, in today's environment, those are things that, you know, you just kind of, it's important to be aware of. You know, because, I think, I don't think children have changed, you know, the even though life has gone on, I don't think children now have changed much as far as their naivety when it comes to, you know, what goes on around them. I mean, their innocence, you know, of what goes around them.
Yeah,
absolutely. And,
So I'm hoping that the book will show people, you know, what certainly went on with me. It's not just plugging it, but it's the website is, as you mentioned, is under. I think it's being reconstructed at the moment, so I'm not quite sure how easy it is to. I did open it the other day, so I know you can still open it. So there's details on there and so on that could be read. The book's available on Amazon. In both printed format and also as an ebook, which is good for people with Kindles and things. So it's there, and my personal email address is in the front of it. So anyone who wants to contact me, they can feel free to do so. Be delighted to hear from them.
Yeah, that's great. That's great, definitely. And yes, the website, I do have that link in the show page description, so people can go there, you know, click on the contact page. Also, since we have just a couple minutes left, you do have another project coming up, right? So it's going to be, just give us a little bit about what Who's Afraid of Tomorrow is going to be about.
Well, that's sort of a thought that I had on as my wedding night ended, not ended, but, you know, the day ended and it was time to go to bed and so on. And I remember sort of, I smoked in those days, I threw my cigarette away and I thought, oh, you know, it can't be as bad as what's happened. You know, who could be afraid of tomorrow? Get on with it. That's hence the title.
Yeah.
And the second book sort of deals with how I got out of the mess I'd got myself into. Because, you know, I'd got married and it just didn't go right. It wasn't going right. There was all manner of problems and, you know, which the beginning of those problems are reflected in the first book, who's, They Can't Touch Him Now. So I had all those issues to deal with and so the second book deals with that. And then, of course, you know, my life as it went on from there, you know, and, I did very well. I became quite successful, considering I had such poor education. I left school at 15 years old with a 25-yard swimming certificate. That's all I had. I had no qualifications whatsoever, and I went on, finally, to be quite a successful businessman. So
yeah.
The book deals with all of that, and the fact some there's a considerable amount of humour in it and funny things. I lived in Africa for 3 years and so on and so on. So all those things are sort of reflected in there. So my life has been far from doom and gloom. It had a bit of a tough start, but you know,
right.
Through hard work
yeah.
and dedication, it sort of ended okay, I feel, or ending okay.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, you know, I think that's wonderful. I'm glad that you're doing that because I think people who have had rough starts need to know that, you know, life does go on and, you know, you can still have a, you know, good, you know, middle to late life as well. So,
yeah.
Well, James, it's really been a delight speaking with you. I really want to thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you, Robert. And thank
you're very
you
welcome.
Listeners.
Yeah, great. You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today joining me from the UK is James Williamson. He is author of They Can't Touch Him Now. Again, you can find out more about James by visiting his website, jameswilliamson-taylor.com. Again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. His book is available on Amazon in print as in Kindle. So definitely check it out there. Go in and purchase it and read the book. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.